Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. President Obama takes the case for health care reform to conservative talk radio, to religious leaders, and to his core supporters. In a letter underscoring the closeness of a potential vote on health care, Senator Ted Kennedy asks Massachusetts lawmakers to change the method for choosing a successor. And Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announces the end of the Cash for Clunkers program. It's over on Monday night. Joining me in the studio for the national hour of our Friday News Roundup, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, Gene Cummings of Politico, and Juan Williams of NPR and Fox News. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
We're inviting our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, I'm a last-minute fill-in here on the Diane Rehm Show. Diane caught her heel in the hem of her slacks while she was dashing across the street yesterday afternoon, and she cracked her pelvis when she fell. She'll be recuperating for the next several weeks. I know we all send her our best wishes for a speedy recovery, so she'll be back sitting in this chair. Let's start by talking about health care. This week, Democrats may have decided on a shift in strategy. Naftali, what are they thinking about doing?
Well, it's become increasingly clear, I think, that the Democrats and Republicans may not be able to reach an agreement on a bipartisan health care deal. That's something that they're working at very hard in the Senate Finance Committee. But it's just hard not to look at the scene and feel like that's pretty much of a long shot at this point. For one thing, a lot of Republicans have been making fairly public, fairly negative comments about the whole initiative, including Senator Grassley, who's supposed to be one of the negotiators. But it also, I think it's important to remember that the political landscape has really shifted. So earlier on, there might have been a reason for the Republicans to show that they were part of this whole health reform effort. I think now the politics have changed somewhat, and there's more of a reason for them to oppose it. And so the Democrats, I think, without giving up entirely, are essentially preparing and gaming out scenarios for the assumption that these talks fail in mid-September.
Is there a single Republican in the House or Senate who has declared himself or herself in favor of the emerging health care bill?
You know, there's not one that I know of. And I think that part of that is the way politics has evolved over the last few years. A lot of the Republicans who might have been in that camp were defeated for re-election in either the last election or the one before that. So you have a fairly conservative Republican group, both in the Senate and in the House. And so you, I think, are likely to end up with the Democrats going it alone. I don't think it's as clear as they decided this week they're going to go it alone. Last week they weren't. But I think it's been moving in this direction as they look around and see no Republican that they feel like they can count on to move ahead with them.
So if Democrats go it alone, Gene, what does that mean? How does that mean the bill or bills might be different?
Well, in many ways, they may not change too dramatically, simply because it wasn't just moderate Republicans that were a problem in the Senate. It was conservative Democrats as well. And so what this may mean is that the conversation shifts from an intense negotiation with Chuck Grassley and Mike Enzi and Sue Collins, who are the and Olympia Snow, who are the Republicans in the room, to Ben Nelson and a group and Evan Bayh and a group of conservative Democrats who have shared concerns about the public plan with those Republicans. So we may still end up with a co-op kind of scenario coming out of the Senate. It is being advocated, in fact, by a conservative Democrat. And so we may not see the legislation change all that dramatically in what Senator Baucus of the Finance Committee has been trying to shape up in the Senate. It would embolden Speaker Pelosi to stick with the public plan over on the House side, because if she's going to do it with Democrats only, then she has that big block of liberals that she definitely needs to hold on to.
Now, Juan, if they go, Democrats end up moving ahead on the assumption they get no or virtually no Republican support, that means they might split the bill in the Senate. Why would they do that? Why a different approach in moving forward in the Senate?
Because they've got to get that those conservative Democratic votes in line. And what we've heard, you know, it's an interesting mix there. You get people like Max Baucus, you know, Democrat, and you get other Democrats who are just saying, we don't think that there's enough support for the public option. And so what we're looking for is, and likely scenario, you go towards then cooperatives and government-supported cooperatives, subsidized cooperatives, that would then allow those conservative Democrats to say, this is not government taking control of the healthcare system, but this is an option that we think will provide competition for the big insurance companies that had previously been excluding people or limiting portability of insurance plans as people shift jobs. Now, you could argue, Susan, that that is a veil for the public option, and I'm sure Republicans will make that case. But apparently it's acceptable among the conservative Democrats.
Well, there's also a technical reason as well that they might have to break up the bill, and that is they would try to move a piece of it under the so-called reconciliation rules, which would only require a majority vote instead of an oversized vote. And
instead of the 60 votes you need to avoid a filibuster.
Mm-hmm. But there are only certain things you can move under reconciliation. And there are even some Democrats who argue that there are pieces of the health care bill that would not qualify under the rules of the Senate to be moved under that particular rule and under a reconciliation process. And so they might have to break it up for that reason. Those that don't qualify under reconciliation rules would have to move outside of it. Now, the problem for them is that if moving one health care bill is bad enough, they're going to try to move two. I mean, this could create even more opportunities for Republicans and opponents to
I think it would be devastating to the bill. I mean, the very idea that the country needs health care reform is, even as it's in decline because of all the static around the bill at the moment, most Americans see that there's a problem with people who are uninsured, with the high cost of insurance and this and that sort of thing. To go towards this reconciliation move really would be to shove it down the throats not only of Republicans but of the public, and so I think it would create much more opposition nationwide than the Republican than the Democrats and the Obama White House want.
Well, what do you think, Naftali? What are the kind of risks and benefits of doing so? I mean, some people might say Democrats have 60 votes in the Senate; they've got a big majority in the House. Why shouldn't they do it alone if Republicans are being so difficult to get on board?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately they may feel like they have no choice, and so I think that for them the alternative is not having any health care bill at all, which I think would be much more devastating for them politically than doing it at least in part through reconciliation. I'm not sure the public follows the parliamentary maneuverings of the Senate that closely, but what they will know at the end of the day is we elected the Democrats, they did get health reform, or they didn't get health reform. There's also, you know, reconciliation. It's this, it's an argument on both sides. You know, the Republicans do see it as shoving it down their throats. The Democrats say it's just what the rest of us call majority vote. I mean, the Senate has a lot of arcane rules, and the people in the Senate put a lot of stock by them. But what it usually means is you need 60 votes to get something through instead of the way the rest of the world works, which is 51 to 49.
It's not just about the 60 votes. It's about even losing some Democrats and then still pushing it through. And that's the problem.
It's also about a big issue like health care, which you'd hope there'd be enough of a national consensus that it would be somewhat bipartisan.
Right.
You know, to move
that was the president's mm-hmm. hope initially. And I must say, we can't let the Republicans get off scot-free in this conversation. I mean, the idea is that even among the Republicans, you see lots of fraying ties here. I think most notably Dick Armey, the former Speaker of the House, deciding to leave his job as a lobbyist because he was representing a lot of the hospitals, the health people who want some kind of deal, but at the same time bad-mouthing the deal. And that just wasn't...
There's also this preliminary battle that's going on where each side wants to lay out the case that if they have to go it alone, it's the other side's fault. And I think the Democrats, and President Obama in particular, are working pretty hard at making the case that, hey, we keep on making these concessions to the Republicans, they keep on saying no, so what other choice do we have?
And moving the deadline. That's what they've also done. He's expanded the time the president has for over and over again for the bipartisan bill to come out, laying the groundwork for when it collapses. He can say, I did everything I could. I gave him all the time.
So what's the current deadline, Gene?
It's September 15th.
And that's for the Senate Finance Committee to come out with a bill so we can move on. You know, huge debate this week on whether this plan will or will not include a public option. And some people heard a change in the language the White House was using on last Saturday when the president addressed a town hall meeting and said the public option, that is a government-run plan that would compete with private insurers, is just a sliver of health care reform. And then on Sunday, Kathleen Sebelius, the HHS secretary, said it was not an essential element of health care reform. Did they intend to send a signal?
I don't know if they intended to, but they did. I think, you know, in the White House's defense, which I don't necessarily always want to be in this position, but I mean, they've been pretty darn consistent. He sent out this, he dropped this notion in the spring, and it set up a little fury of fear and flurry of fear and anxiety among liberals. But they have said pretty much all along, it's what the president wants, but he's not going to draw a line in the sand. And they said it differently this time. It's, we are closer to the end line right now, and it really mattered, I think, and was heard this time in a way it wasn't heard way back in the spring.
Boy, a big reaction, Juan, from liberals in the Democratic Party.
You know, the Progressive Caucus in the House, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, that she really insists she cannot get a bill through the House without the public options, what she said. Chris Dodd, who got the bill, really was the designer of the bill, along with Ted Kennedy, in the Senate Health, Education, Labor, Pension Committee, I believe, said, you know what, we've got to have the public option. Howard Dean, former chair of the DNC and former presidential candidate, you know, sought the Democratic nomination himself, Vermont governor. He said, you know, it's not realistic. You're not really doing health reform unless you have the public option. But from the, again, from the White House perspective, they're trying to offer some compromise, some way to make a deal. And I think they did intend to put up that trial balloon. It's just that it got such a negative reaction from the left.
We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our phone line is open, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet, or you can reach us on Facebook. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Juan Williams. He's an NPR news analyst and a Fox News political analyst. Jean Cummings. She's Politico's assistant managing editor in charge of enterprise. And Naftali Ben-David. He's a national correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Well, we've just heard that the chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, has given a speech in Kansas City, a speech in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, about the economy, reflections on a year of crisis. He says the economy is on the cusp of recovery. How does it look to you, Jean?
Well, I think if you're the head of the Fed, you look at a lot of numbers and statistics, and you look at those numbers, and we do seem to have hit the bottom. We do seem to be moving in the direction of recovery. The problem with selling that is that the unemployment rate is going to continue to be difficult. People are still going to lose jobs. Jobs is the last bit of recovery in any recovery. It's a lagging indicator. And so I think the average person is not going to feel much of a recovery out there. That's evident by consumer confidence, which is not going up. And foreclosures continue to mount. And so for the average person, it sure doesn't feel like a recovery right now.
The Mortgage Bankers Association this week reported that 1 in 8 households with mortgages was in foreclosure or late on its mortgage payments in the second quarter. 1 in 8. That's just an amazing number, Juan.
It is. And, you know, again, there's a need here for government to figure out what they can do and what's reasonable to do. And it's not exactly, you've seen the cash for clunkers, as you mentioned, Susan, it's going to end soon. but it's not as if you can do sort of cash for houses or cash for cupcakes and just keep going down the road here. So the foreclosure issue is big. The unemployment issue is big. I would come back to something Gene just mentioned, consumer confidence, that what you see is people savings rates going up, people just sitting on dollars because they're fearful. The level of anxiety around the economy has not subsided despite the reassuring words from Ben Bernanke.
I do like the idea of cash for cupcakes, so I think that's something maybe the government should look at.
The quandary, I think, for the government now is that the cause of the foreclosures is totally different. It's now all intertwined with joblessness. And so, you know, it's one thing if you had somebody who signed on to a bad interest rate and you try to figure out how to tinker with that interest rate. But somebody who's lost their job, what do you do with that? They're going to lose their house. And so that's the trouble, is that we have like this really negative cycle of joblessness, foreclosure that keeps feeding on itself.
Now, the president this week did call the Cash for Clunkers program a resounding success. If you want to buy a car with a trade-in, you might want to do it this weekend because that program ends on Monday evening. Did it do, Naftali, what it was intended to do?
I mean, I think in many ways it did. It was always supposed to be a short-term jolt to the economy. It wasn't supposed to be some kind of a long-term recovery program. And it's pretty clear that people took advantage of it. A lot more cars were bought. Car makers had to hire people, and certainly that sector has improved. You know, and I think it plays into this larger argument that we're all talking about. What can and should government do? And along those lines as well, there was a recent poll, I think, in the Washington Post that showed that more people believe that the stimulus plan has worked than think that it hasn't worked. But that's another big debate that's going on. And I think how that debate goes will affect not only what the government decides to do in the future, but how the next election goes.
Gene, there's some sense that we may be ending a new phase in the banking crisis. We've got a Spanish bank on the verge of buying Guarantee Financial Group, Inc., which is a Texas bank that's on the verge of collapse. This would be the first time, wouldn't it, that a non-U.S. financial institution would take over a failing U.S. bank?
It's the first time that I know of, and perhaps an indication that you know, globally, people are gaining some confidence, although it's a very small transaction. I think if you listen to Treasury, there is a sense that we've stabilized pretty much the banking system. That doesn't mean that there won't be banks that go down. We clearly saw, one go down this week. But the other thing that is a good indicator is that the Treasury Department decided it could give back or doesn't need another $250 billion to hold, an account somewhere, so it's ready to go out and stabilize more banks. They now have said they don't need that money.
Now, that also had the effect of bringing down the projected deficit this week.
Absolutely. The government now is suggesting that our deficit will be 1.58 instead of 1.7 plus. And so, you know, there's that bit of good news for the administration, too, although that's still a very large deficit. But, the idea, it does two things, I guess. It did reduce the estimated deficit, but it also sent a signal of the government's confidence in that there is a stabilization in the banking system.
Well, let's take calls from some listeners. We'll go to Maryland and talk to Natalie. Natalie, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. This is my very first time.
Oh, well, thank you for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
I was calling because in listening to your earlier segment, I wondered what has happened to Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who made a proposal that the health care be passed with the requirement that the ordinary private insurance companies have to meet ethical requirements such as no pre-existing conditions and no dropping if you really get sick and so on. And if in 4 years they have, and they also have to lower the cost of insurance. And if in 4 years they haven't met those requirements, the public option kicks in with no new vote necessary. I'm personally in favor of the public option, but if this is the only way to get it through, or if this is a good bipartisan way to get it through the Senate, why aren't people talking about it?
You know, Natalie, thanks for your call. This is what's sometimes called the trigger option. One, why hasn't it gone farther, do you think?
I mean, the Republicans don't buy it. I mean, don't see it as anything but another way to get towards public option. They don't see it as realistic. They see it as intervening in a marketplace in an unfair way, putting an unfair burden on the insurance companies. If in fact insurance companies found this a way that they could viably make money and still offer insurance, the assumption is they would be doing it. And so that's why the co-ops then become an option, because you could say the co-ops, which would be totally nonprofit, would in fact create that kind of competitive alternative.
I don't think that that proposal is dead. I think that looks pretty ripe for a conference committee. If we have a bill come out of the House that's got a public plan, and we got a bill that comes out of the Senate that's got a co-op, how do you negotiate those two? The trigger is the most obvious path. And it would then put the onus on the insurance industry to make those co-ops work. If they don't want a public plan, it would then give them 5 years, 10 years, whatever the trigger date is, to make them work. And if they didn't work, then, you know, this is the second time the insurance industry has gone to Congress and said, we don't need a public plan. We could do this. We can create the products and put them out there. They have never done that. They didn't do it after 93. They claim they'll do it now. That would give them a window to go out there and prove it.
You know, Naftali, it's interesting the role that the two senators from Maine, which is, you know, one of our least populous states, the critical role they have turned out to play in this debate.
And not just the two states from Maine. I mean, there are right now six senators from the Finance Committee that are deeply involved in trying to come out with a bipartisan plan. And if anything emerges that does have support in both parties, that's going to be what it is. But the six senators, interestingly, all come from very small states. Every one of them has a tiny population. I think all of them together are smaller than a whole group of states. And it's just the way the Senate plays out. You know, it's just the way it often works. And a lot of people have noted it and have wondered whether or not, you know, it's affecting the final product. But as far as the senators from Maine, there's one other point to be made, which is there are now two moderate Republicans in the Senate. That's it, two. There was Arlen Specter, and now he's a Democrat. And so it's a very small margin that you're dealing with. And I think some of the key people involved in the negotiations, like Senator Grassley and Senator Enzi, you know, they're very conservative. And the good part of that is if you win them over, maybe you win over a bunch more Republicans. The bad part of it is it's made coming to any sort of a deal much more difficult.
Well, we have an email from Russ, who writes us from Princeton Junction, New Jersey, saying, when the Republican point man on efforts to obtain a bipartisan bill, Senator Charles Grassley, is himself demagoguing about Democratic proposals to pull the plug on grandma, why would you ever believe that he is a partner worth dealing with? Lots of news this week about Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, conservative Republican, and what he is signaling about Republican intentions, Juan.
Well, you know, Senator Grassley's in a very tricky position. On the one hand, you have Republicans who say that he does not represent them, and they don't want him to become the face of Republican negotiation in the Senate Finance Committee. Chuck Grassley, from his position, says, you know what, I want to try to represent Republicans in this mix. I want to try to bring something forward that Republicans could sign on to. Then he goes home, and he's in these town hall meetings, and he's getting beat up to a large extent. And he's not, from the White House perspective, offering any retort to what they consider to be misinformation about the health care plan. So they think, well, wait a second, he's not a fair player here. He's not, in fact, trying to work with us. And that's what's signaled or triggered a lot of the discussion that, as we engaged in at the top of the show, about Democrats saying, well, maybe there's no hope that any Republican is going to work with us if Chuck Grassley isn't going to be an above board player in terms of saying exactly what's true and what's not true about the president's prospective plan.
You know, there was an amazing New York NBC Wall Street Journal poll this week that asked people about provisions of the health care plan. And half or close to half of Americans believe that it includes these panels to review end-of-life care. It doesn't. That it would cover illegal aliens. These plans do not do that. Various aspects of the bill that people believe are part of it, but that aren't. What does that reflect? Does it reflect a disinformation campaign, or does it mean that the advocates just haven't done a good job in explaining it?
It's both. The opponents of the bill had very clear talking points, very powerful, emotionally laden language that they cherry-picked for most impact, and they were ready. And what is astonishing is that the Obama administration, with all of the praise that it got through the campaign, the White House seemed caught completely off guard by this. Now, they claim that they were out there canvassing and going door to door, but nothing is more powerful than the, you know, the fury that was on display in those first town hall meetings, and the Democrats seemed to be completely flat-footed. I think that they are doing better now. They're getting more people out into the town halls to balance them out. I think Specter and some of the other senators who stood up to the grilling and the heat helped themselves because they showed they were knowledgeable about the bill, that they were passionate about aspects of it, and they were open to all kinds of questions, including hostile ones. So I think some Democrats might have helped themselves, but it hurt the bill and its momentum pretty significantly.
Well, I think it's key here that the biggest asset that the White House has in trying to advance this bill is President Barack Obama and the fact that the American people trust him far more than they trust the Republicans in Congress on health care. And yet, President Obama refused, I guess this is looking back at what happened to the Clinton plan, to articulate specifically what it was that he believed was necessary. I mean, we were talking earlier about public option, for example, and he's saying, well, you know, I believe in it, but I'm not drawing a line in the sand, I think is the way you put it, Susan. So people say, well, so what is he willing, what's he really stand for? And then he says, you know, I want people on the Hill to negotiate. Well, what that did was it opened the door for them to start using what would be uncharitably called scare tactics, to start talking about rationing health care, about pulling the plug on grandma, death panels, to quote Sarah Palin. This kind of stuff has damaged the effort tremendously.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, Naftali, there have been times in the past 2 weeks when you've seen the president, I think, really begging for more hostile questions. They've tried to make the town halls that he's done, I think three of them, open to more people in the hopes that he'll get tough questions. He did a conservative radio talk show host over at the White House yesterday on his show, but got mostly softball questions. It seems like it's very hard for people to ask the president the kind of tough question that he could then bat out of the park.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost been a comical element of it. You saw at this one town hall meeting where he had to say, okay, can we have a negative question, please? Which is not something you usually see from politicians. But I think this plays into another aspect. You know, we've been talking about President Obama's message. In the campaign, he was so successful at his lofty rhetoric and soaring moral calls to arms. And recently, he's found himself caught up in these little sort of niggling debates about what exactly the panel, end-of-life panels would do and a public option does versus a COA. He hasn't said we have a moral obligation to cover every American in this country. That sort of language has been somewhat absent. And what you're seeing is the White House is starting to turn more to that. I mean, he's been meeting with faith leaders. I think some of the attempts to talk to conservative callers and others, I mean, shows that he's trying to get back to the sort of unifying, uplifting theme that he was so successful at. He's trying to introduce that into the health
debate. Well, I think part of the deal initially from the White House perspective was to try to create allies. I mean, that's why they were trying to buy in the insurance companies, the hospitals. By the way, that's what created a lot of the conflicts for the Republicans who had become lobbyists for these, you know, big businesses. And so the way that you do that, you don't vilify them. You don't somehow demonize, let's say, hospitals or insurance companies. But then what that means is that you're not making it clear to the American people that in some cases it's the insurance companies and the hospitals who have been, in fact, rationing. We've had rationing in this country. Don't you think if you go before an insurance company and they say, no, we're not going to provide money for that service, it's rationing? But you know what? The White House hasn't said that very clear. President Obama hasn't said it very clear. I mean, it's incredible. Even if you look at their effort now to get Organizing for America back in gear, which was the group that was so effective in terms of grassroots organizing for the Obama campaign, people are slow to come to it. The group's just not there.
But I think they knocked themselves off their own message in a way. They got caught by the Republicans with the death panels and all of that conversation. And then the balloon or whatever they were trying to do on the public plan set off the liberals. And in fact, what they had hoped to do was to spend the month of August talking to the middle class and people who have health insurance. Their plan in August was to talk about the fact that the legislation would ban refusal for pre-existing conditions and all of the reforms of the insurance industry that will benefit those people who already have insurance. And their plan was to build support for the bill by talking to the people who have insurance. They are not talking to those people anymore. They're fighting amongst themselves.
You know, it seems to me this is exactly the August that the White House did not want to have. That's why the president had set a deadline for the House and Senate to act before they left on their August recess. Instead, we've had an August where the opponents have had the strong voice, getting the news coverage, raising questions with people, picking away at pieces of the bill. It has not been what the White House hoped to see.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. There was so much emphasis on getting a bill through the House and through the Senate, so you had something very specific to defend. Instead, there's five bills. One of them isn't even complete yet, floating out there. Some of them contradict each other. And so when there's an attack, it's very hard to say, no, look at the bill. This isn't what it says.
Yeah, I think
because,
in fact, there
isn't a bill.
There's no bill. And I would add one more thing in here, which is really just fortuitous for the opponents, which is the high level of economic anxiety in the country has made this much more conversation about how much is this going to cost, and the CBO saying it's going to cost much more than the administration's admitting, and not everybody's going to be covered. And so individuals, getting back to what Gene was talking about in terms of the White House wanting to focus on consumer protections for people who have insurance, instead people are saying, oh, is this going to cost me more? Oh, my gosh. And, you know, how much more am I going to have to pay?
Juan Williams is with NPR, and we're also joined by Gene Cummings and Naftali Ben-David. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss news about the CIA and its use of Blackwater, and we'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Vote counting continues in Afghanistan after yesterday's election. Insurgents in Iraq target the foreign and finance ministry buildings, killing scores and wounding hundreds. And the man behind the Lockerbie bombing returns to Libya. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Gene Cummings from Politico, Naftali Ben-David from The Wall Street Journal, and Juan Williams from NPR and Fox News. Well, we've got an email from Ron, who writes us from Buffalo, New York. He says, please comment on Tom Ridge's allegation about the terrorist alerts. Fox News ran them more than any other news outlet. What's he talking about, Gene?
Well, in an upcoming book, the former first Homeland Security Secretary, Tom Ridge, will apparently allege that before the 2004 presidential, right after the Democratic National Convention, in which John Kerry got a good bump, that Ridge was pressured by members of the cabinet, including Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, to move up the threat level to orange. And ultimately, it did happen, and it did refocus the debate. But Ridge resisted that, and in his book will say that he, at that point, decided that it was best for him to leave the administration.
That seems like a pretty serious allegation, doesn't it, Juan?
Well, not according to Donald Rumsfeld, our former Secretary of Defense, who says that there's a pattern of terrorist attacks all coming around the time of elections, and that they had a tape. Remember, Osama bin Laden was making noises just then. So he's saying it was totally justified and it wasn't politically oriented, and that maybe he doesn't go on to say this, but the suggestion would be that maybe Tom Ridge is out there trying to push a book.
Well, Rumsfeld may not say that, but a lot of other people are saying that.
Naftali, we had two news stories in the New York Times yesterday and today involving the CIA use of that firm called Blackwater that's been so controversial. What did the story say?
Well, the first one was actually fairly dramatic. This has to do with this program that was secret for a long time that the CIA had to assassinate leaders of al-Qaeda. It was controversial. It was never reported to Congress until Leon Panetta, the current CIA director, took over and decided to cancel the program and tell Congress. And as if that weren't enough intrigue, now it turns out that Blackwater, this very controversial company that got into trouble for aggressive tactics in Iraq, was subcontracted essentially to help with that program. And then the following story just as simply that in this current program that uses drones to go after al-Qaeda leaders, Blackwater operatives were helping there too. And what this is going to do is it's going to open up once again this whole question about not only the CIA and how it's going about its business in the war against terrorism, but the whole idea of subcontracting these very sensitive matters to private companies and whether that's a good idea.
Now, President Ford had signed an executive order in 1976 that outlawed the CIA, said the CIA could not carry out assassination. So does this violate that law or that executive order?
Well, it could if, in fact, they are funding assassinations. That's the question. But technically, the CIA wasn't doing that. And what they're doing is, of course, targeting terrorists. Mm-hmm. And so the argument would be, shouldn't we be going after terrorists? And the answer, most Americans would say, is yes. But if it's a matter of the law, that's a different issue.
And, of course, the Bush administration and especially then Vice President Cheney had argued that al-Qaeda operatives are enemy soldiers and therefore it wouldn't be a political assassination that of the sort that President Ford was trying to ban. Now, this program, Congress wasn't told about it at the time. Why weren't they, Gene?
Well, we've heard from at least two previous CIA directors who said basically it was still in its planning stages, that it was they had never reached an operational point, and so they didn't feel like they needed to go and tell Congress about it because they didn't know if they'd ever be deployed or if anything would ever really come of it. Certainly, Leon Panetta took a different approach, and as soon as he heard about it, he terminated it and went directly to the Hill. And that lack of notice of what was going on is definitely going to be investigated further. Senator Dianne Feinstein believes that laws were broken in the fact that her committee and others were not informed about it.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll talk to Andrew. He's calling us from Frisco, Texas. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
My question is related to the economy. I've heard several economists that have essentially said that there's a possibility that we might be facing a W-shaped recession, and I was wondering if the panel could comment on what we could be facing whenever the government starts pulling out the artificial support of the economy. For instance, you know, the Fed's credit medicine, so to speak.
Now, Gene, tell us what a W-shaped recession would be.
Well, basically, it's a double dip or triple dip. I've heard some people talk about W's. I've heard more people talk about V's.
And some people talk about U's.
U's, yeah. But basically, what the concern is that we've gone through this sharp, sharp, steep decline. So there you've got the first slash of your W. And then we start a modest recovery. So we're moving into the middle of our W. And then inflation concerns take hold. And that is the witching hour for our recovery, whether there's real inflation or it's simply the expectation of inflation. That's when the Fed will have to make a decision about whether it will have to start to begin to tighten up its lending and to start withdrawing all of the cash flow that it injected into the economy to try to battle back against inflation. And when they do withdraw that, anytime the Fed has done such a thing in the past, it has caused a recession. And so that would be the other side of the middle of your W.
Now, then, a V recession would be what?
That we go down and we recover and we zoom back up.
And a U would be?
A U would be we go down, we have a modest bottom out, slow down there, no jobs being created, much of what we're experiencing now. And then then we begin to recover and we come up on the other side of the U.
Here's an email from Brian, who writes us from Raleigh, North Carolina. He says, the law allowing the governor to appoint an interim senator in Massachusetts was changed in 2004 when the Democrats in the Massachusetts legislature figured out that John Kerry was going to win the presidency and they didn't want the Republican governor, Mitt Romney, appointing his replacement. Now that there is a Democrat in the governor's mansion, they want to change it back. Will anyone point out the hypocrisy of this potential move? Naftali, now this comes up because of a letter that Senator Ted Kennedy, who of course is battling a brain tumor, wrote this week or sent this week to leaders in Massachusetts.
I mean, I think to answer the question, I think there's little question that there is, let's say, a double standard if they go ahead and do this. I mean, when there was a Republican governor, they didn't want it, and now that there's a Democratic one, they do. It's not clear that it's going to happen, but certainly there's a movement. Even before Senator Kennedy's letter, there was a movement among some Massachusetts Democrats. And the reason is this. You know, the Democrats have, in name, a 60-seat majority, if you count a couple independents who vote with them. But in fact, because both Senator Kennedy and Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia are ailing, they often don't vote. 60 is a very important number in the Senate. It's what it takes to break a filibuster. And if Senator Kennedy should have to step down, then the special election in Massachusetts can't take place for, I think it's 150 days or something like that. So that would mean there'd be a vacancy, and the Democrats would not have their 60
votes. A lot of hypocrisy here, don't you think?
Yeah, but
I mean, rank hypocrisy. And I think given that Roland Burris is in the Senate from Illinois, again appointed, I think this is an opportunity for people to have serious conversations about ending this practice and simply having special elections.
Well, Even though it means the seat would be vacant for some months.
Well, for a few months, but you could have a special election in relatively short time. The question would be actually cost. The argument would be it's going to cost a lot to have an election.
Well, I don't think cost will matter. I think this will be a purely partisan choice in honor of Senator Kennedy and to help President Obama. And there are a few sure things in life, but I'd put my money on them changing the rules so that they can put somebody in that seat.
I mean, there is a poignancy, though, leaving aside the special election issue. You know, Senator Kennedy has been working for this for 40 years, and just as it really nears perhaps its best opportunity for reality, he's stricken down himself with a health matter and has had to watch this thing more and more from the sidelines. It's not clear whether he'll be able to return to the Senate at all. And his absence, if that happens, might come at the exact crucial point when his vote is most needed by the Democrats who are trying to pass something. And the fact that he wrote this letter was, I thought, in some ways, for all its political aspects, a kind of a poignant recognition that his time is limited.
One of the most significant things I think about that letter was it was drafted July 2nd, and he sent it now.
What does that mean to you?
To me, that's just a pretty sad indication that his condition may be worsening.
All right. Let's go talk to Howard, who's calling us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Howard, thank you for holding on.
Not a problem at all, Susan. I'm sitting here looking at the front page of your newspaper, USA Today, and it says, Federal Reserve says, recession, the worst of the recession is over. Well, I'm here to tell you that the rumor the economy is bad is really true. And I'm self-employed, have been for 14 years, used to making a very comfortable living. I've never had a year like this, and I'm going to have to do some legal action to take care of it. But what has the Obama administration done, if anything, for people who are self-employed? There are a number of us out there. I'm not eligible for unemployment insurance because I don't pay into the system. I have to pay both sides of Social Security. And we're a big part of the economy. I generate jobs. I normally pay people to work and that sort of thing. And that's just I could go on for a long time, but I'm not hearing about it. And I did not support Obama. I'm a big John McCain fan. But, you know, you have to buy into the president that we have. So, in any case, I'm just curious.
Howard, thanks so much for your call. So, you know, people who are self-employed, a big part of the economy, they generate a lot of jobs, when they have these small businesses. How are they doing, Gene?
Well, it's mixed. I mean, I have to say that I think Obama and Congress have tried to keep an eye out for them. There was some money in the stimulus and an effort to try to loosen up some small business lending and get that going. I think part of that process was hampered by the fact that the cabinet positions were not getting filled in a rapid way when I think those businesses in particular were most in need. I think with independent business owners, some those that make less than $250,000, you know, there are provisions aimed at that area, or at least an attempt not to put any other financial pressure on them. And certainly with the healthcare, they have, you know, set some standards around small businesses and this, and also this income threshold, mm-hmm. to try to protect small businesses from the impact and to actually try to help them, because many small businesses and many independent business owners like this one, self-employed, have really high healthcare costs. And so by getting these exchanges in place and either a public plan or a co-op, whatever they might do, it might be enable someone like him to get health insurance at a much lower cost, which of course would help his business.
But the other side of this is that from his position, Howard in Cincinnati, I think, so much money has gone to big business. So much money has gone to bail out the Wall Street types, and very little money has gone specifically to small business or independent business operators. Now, I think Gene's point is well taken. If from the administration's perspective, from Treasury Secretary Geithner's perspective, there was an effort to make sure that the credit markets didn't get frozen, that money was available to those people, so you had to put money into that, and you had to keep money going towards the big Wall Street banks.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a sort of related email from Charles, who writes us from Plainwell, Michigan. He says, my comment is that I have three vehicles with over 100,000 miles each, but none of them qualify as a clunker because they all get over 18 miles per gallon. So because I bought sensible vehicles, I don't benefit from Obama's largesse.
I mean, that's a fair point. You know, this cash for clunkers thing, and it actually suffered from this a little bit during the debate. It had several different goals. I mean, it was supposed to try to help automakers. It was supposed to try to help individuals, but it was also supposed to improve the environment. And so here you have a situation where, for this particular individual, those goals are coming into conflict. And that's been a sort of an issue that's dogged this program all along.
Now, we had developments this week on those Guantanamo Bay detainees. More than 12 countries have agreed to accept them. So how are things going, Gene, do you think, with President Obama's effort to close down Gitmo by the end of the year?
Well, inch by inch, they're making some progress. You know, we have probably a dozen countries now that have agreed to take handfuls of these detainees. But, you know, there are more than 200 of them. And, you know, the deadline of 2010 is clicking along. I think that we are just beginning to start to have what could be a very intense debate about where they might come back to in the United States.
Now, we've had several callers, including Nick from Winchester, Virginia, call to say that one reason there are so many misunderstandings or falsehoods about the healthcare plan is because the news media has not done its job in clearing them up. Do you think that's a fair criticism, Juan? What do you think?
Well, I think that part of it is it's very complex, and it's slow going in terms of arguments, let's say, about death panels. The news media, in fact, has gone and found people who are the policymakers who have been involved in this, and they've made it very clear there is no such thing as a death panel. But you know what? Rationing does take place in this healthcare system now, and they have given thoughts about how you deal with people who are in end-of-life stage. And, of course, those people are very expensive, and so there is thought about exactly how you deal with them effectively. I think it was pretty funny that there was one publication that had listed Stephen Hawking the other day as an example of someone who would have died if he hadn't been in America and subjected, had the opportunity to take advantage of America's healthcare system, and would have died if he had been in Britain or Canada. And it turns out, of course, Stephen Hawking lives in Britain and has been kept alive by the British healthcare system. There's lots of misinformation out there, and I think, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, the misinformation has carried the day because there isn't a clear articulation of exactly what the White House or the healthcare proponents are standing
for.
Just
real quick, I think we're guilty. I think that all of the attention, especially on the 24-hour cable stations, to three or four town hall meetings that got heated, shaped this debate. And as we learned, there were many other town hall meetings that were not that adversarial. They got no coverage. So I think we are guilty, at least at that.
Two giants in journalism died this week. Don Hewitt, creator of 60 Minutes, he directed the first network television newscast. He produced the first televised presidential debate, the one between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. He was the founder of 60 Minutes on CBS. And also Robert Novak died this week. He was the political columnist who became quite enmeshed in controversy himself on the Valerie Plame affair, but someone who was always known as an incredibly dogged reporter himself.
just a terrific reporter, and in fact, I think effective, because sources knew that if they didn't deal with Novak, and they might not have wanted to, somebody else was going to have to, might be talking, and therefore they wanted to get their spin on the story first. And so he became sort of like the 411, you know, the local wire for people who were very much inside politics, especially on the conservative side. They wanted to know exactly what Novak had and read his column as if they were reading tea leaves.
You know, he was someone who delighted in going on the stage of the Gridiron Show, a group of journalists in silly costumes, really making a fool of himself. He went dressed as Kermit the Frog in one song. His last role on the Gridiron stage was as Dick Cheney, dressed in a Darth Vader costume.
You know, it's hard not to see the passing of those two guys. You don't want to oversimplify things, but it's something of the end of an era. I mean, they represented traditional television, which is being overcome by cable television, and traditional newspapers, which are being overcome by the internet. And just to tie it back to the previous question, you know, people ask whether we've done a good enough job of debunking the myths. I think in some occasions we've tried, but nobody necessarily believes us anymore.
Naftali Ben-David, Gene Cummings, and Juan Williams, thank you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Good to be with you, Susan.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.